Hi, I'm Roy Colin, and I'm the creator of the podcast. You can find everything about me and the five podcasts on bio.link/podcaster, and you'll find it in the QR code there. I'd also like to thank my sponsors. If you or someone you know is struggling with anxiety and want to know how to be 100% anxiety free in 6 weeks without therapy or drugs, Daniel Packard Anxiety Solution Program Company offers a 6 weeks system that permanently solves anxiety at an astounding 90% success rate. People who join the program only pay at the end once they have clear, measurable results. If you're interested in learning more, go to permanentanxietysolutions.com, where you can book a free consultation with Daniel. You have high blood pressure and want to get off the meds? Doctors are amazed at what Zona Plus can do. Get a $50 discount with my code ROY. Go to zona.com/discount/Roy, and you see the QR code for all my sponsors down at the end. Quality Polish manufacturer of metal products for telecommunication and workshop equipment and other metals. If you'd like a brochure, you see it in the QR code, and you just let us know if you would like a quotation shipped internationally and very competitive rates. I hope you enjoy this week's podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Quantum Nurse Freedom International live stream. Warm greetings to all of you from all of us. And today we're going to have a really very good, empowering, and perhaps conversation, or not perhaps, for sure, it's a conversation so that we don't keep falling on the same trap again and again and again. Because that's really not very good for all of us. And also, could you imagine if we still haven't opened our eyes to what's really been happening? In we're just even asking for what's happening in the last 4 years. But all these things that we're going to talk about has been happening for centuries. Most of us weren't even born yet. So we have Alex Craner, and I thank you again and again for his dedication and commitment in his Substack. So you could get him from Substack, the Alex Craner's Trend Compass at Substack.com. And he also has his blog, the NakedHedgie.com. And Alex Craner is a author, a market analyst, futures trader, investor, and he has a background in managing funds. But most of all, he is truly awake, and he knows how to connect the dots that could make us really understand without much anger. You know, when I say anger, like we become really vengeful, that we just suddenly put ourselves in one side and the other and not really analyzing everything. So, and Alex has a lot of books that I'm going to put in the ticker here, and I want Alex to talk about those books a little bit, so for you, and especially those has a free download things. So Alex, thank you again, and please, yeah, let them know what you've been up to and what really triggered you and maintained you and motivated you to do what you're doing now.
I think the main Grace, thank you, by the way, first of all, and warm greetings from Monaco to all the participants and all the viewers and listeners. What has motivated me principally is the commitment to do what I can to defend peace and to prevent an outbreak of war that I've been sensing since, let's call it 2016, 2017. 2015. I can put the date on there because that's the date. That's the year when I read Bill Browder's book, Red Notice. And Red Notice is the, it was a bestseller on Amazon. It has like 5 billion five-star reviews, and basically the man who wrote it, Bill Browder, used to be the largest the owner and manager of the largest foreign-owned hedge fund in Russia during the 1990s. And I met him twice, and I had a vague idea about him, about what he's about, what he does, and all of these things. And it is thanks to him that I started paying attention to the relationship between Russia and the West. And up until I got a copy of his book from my ex-wife, I used to think of him as a positive character, as a good guy. And then I read his book, and I was very perplexed, because I knew about things that he was writing about, and it didn't add up. And anyway, to cut the long story short, reading his book made me realize that he's not just one lone fund manager out there to generate the highest possible return on investment for his investors, that he was part of a much, much larger network. And I realized that these people are the network that could drag us into a World War III between Russia and the Western powers. And so that's how I wrote my second book, called The Grand Deception, because I thought I thought somebody needed to unmask this man and the people who are behind him. And then I realized, well, I think that I probably know more about this than the average person. And so I thought maybe I have to write it myself. And I decided to do that because I'm a father. If I have to be able to tell myself that I did what I could to make sure that my children don't end up as cannon fodder, and that they can live a good life in prosperity and security. And that kind of took a life all of its own, because my book got banned literally 5 weeks after I published it. And then it got picked up by a publisher named Red Pill Press, who, combed over the book to make sure there was nothing in there that was inaccurate, that they could get sued over. And then they republished it with a different title, because the original title was The Killing of William Browder. And so they thought maybe that, the killing in the title might have been an offending factor. So we renamed it Grand Deception. And then they published it under their own label. And then it took 6 weeks for it to get banned again. And basically, that was pretty much a confirmation that I was over the target. And so I kind of remained, in addition to my day job, which is no longer, it's related to financial market, but I no longer manage directly people's investments. I no longer work as a fund manager. But, being active, writing, publishing has become part of my life. And as I observe things happening, we saw over the last several years that we really are moving dangerously in the direction of military escalations. And so I just feel an inner compulsion to try to push the other way towards greater peace, greater understanding, greater security. And I think that the truth is the light that is shining the way forward. So I'm, I read, I research, I'm trying to understand what's going on, and I try to share my understanding of what's going on. And I think that as events have unfolded, I think that they have pretty much borne out that I'm generally on the right track with the way I see things, which is, in a way not so good, but in a way it's very good, because I'm also, in addition to being very concerned about the outbreak of World War III, I'm also generally very optimistic about the future we could potentially leave behind for future generations. So that's the good part, and that's the part that is additionally motivating.
Yeah, I can truly say that you're living your life of motivation, and I can see that because on the way you write on the truth that, and yeah, if possible, when we can hope that what you're writing is not true, but it is true. So we have no other choice but to really just feel it. But at the end, you will always insert, whether it's in your writing or in your public speaking, your faith in the creativity of humanity, and that you will. There's always something that we have accomplished so powerfully, except that it's never been on the mainstream education to make us feel that. So I thought that whenever there's something that mainstream says, don't listen to this or don't do that, it's like I kind of think that's the opposite of what I need to do. And so when you wrote, and I like this topic, war, not because I love war or no one loves war, but it's happening. And although they say we're in the precipice, for me, we are at war in a different scale. So in your article, and you place their oligarchy's great, the war is an oligarchy's great silencer. What do you mean by that? And what are they trying to silence? And this is just one of the many questions I have in my mind in terms of war. And I'll just mention other questions. And I just like you to help us and the viewers understand, how do we make sense of everything that's happening? How do we not get into the trap? And yeah, what are they trying to silence? Is war necessary? And who really benefits in the war? So I like to kind of lead us in that conversation. And thank you so much for everything that you do in all your writing and being always accepting my invitation to come back.
Well, it's a Grace, it's a pleasure to accept your invitations. I very much enjoy connecting with you on this podcast. And that's very kind what you said. To try to explain, we have to start with the financial system, you know, to try to explain the global events. And I know that this is a slightly convoluted explanation, but it's the only one that actually makes sense and is consistent with everything that we can observe happening around the world. So, you know, we have a monetary system that is absolutely fraudulent, and it is based on fiat currency and fractional reserve lending. Now, the effect of this system is that you always tend to have a lot more debt in the economic system than you have money to pay off those debts. So the debts are unpayable. It's mathematical, and it's only a question of time. This system is only grows the system is only stable insofar as it grows. So the reason is that all the money that gets put into circulation in an economy reflects debt. So if for any amount of euros or dollars or yen or whatever currency you want to pick in the world, for any amount of it to get into circulation, somebody has to take on debt. The problem is that only the principal goes into circulation of that debt, but it has to be paid back with interest. So if you take a typical mortgage, maybe, you know, you borrow $100,000, but over the life of the mortgage of whatever, 20, 25, 30 years, you have to pay double as much, except that only $100,000 became available as purchasing power the moment you took on that mortgage. And so the only way for there to be additional money in circulation is for other people to get into debt. And then, you know, they have to repay it with interest too. So the whole system is a giant Ponzi scheme, literally. So it's only stable for as long as you can draw more and more and more people into it. But, you know, any economy has only a finite capacity to carry debt. You know, you can continue paying off $100,000 debt or $500,000 debt, whatever, but you can't take on 10 million or 50 million or $1 billion of debt. So it really is finite. And it starts to level off, you know, at the moment where, you know, the principal chunks of infrastructure in society have been built. People have homes, jobs, cars, second cars, holiday homes. They have clothes on their back. They're well fed. You know, from that point on, nobody's very strongly inclined to go deeper into debt to buy a third, fifth, tenth home and 15th car, and you know, it levels off. So at that point, the system is at risk of collapsing because it's no longer growing at a sufficient rate to keep it stable. And so at that point, you have to get the government into the game. And the governments, you know, they have to take on debt. It's not sufficient for them to just tax and spend, because taxation doesn't create additional purchasing power. It just shifts purchasing power from, you know, people who earned it to the government. And it changes the nature of spending, because you and I might spend our money in one way, the government is going to spend it in a different way. And what tends to happen usually is that governments favor military spending. Not everywhere, not in all countries, but in, let's say, these imperially and colonially inclined nations, it tends to be military spending. In other cultures, in other countries, you know, you get spending on monuments, on space programs, on infrastructure programs, pyramids, cathedrals, whatever. But in the Western world, in colonial nations like Great Britain, France, United States, Spain, the politics has tended to strongly favor military spending. Now, when the system starts to go into a crisis, because as you pay off debts, when debts are being paid off, money gets extinguished, right? That money disappears. And now you start having loss of purchasing power in the system. And then you start having crises. And then people's ability to carry debt and to service it diminishes. So you have to start imposing, austerity. And this austerity gets more and more savage, and people start really suffering. You know, they have difficulties making ends meet. You end up with a lot of unemployed people. You get more and more homeless people. The government have to divert more and more money towards repayment of debt and away from, social services like healthcare and policing and, keeping the cities clean, maintenance of libraries, parks, and so on. And so now people start getting really, really unhappy with the situation, and you have social pressures that build up. And then, you know, the result is, and it has been for more than 2,000 years, the result has been, hey, let's go to war. Because, you know, the segment of the population that represents the greatest risk to the established order are, let's say, military age men, you know. And these military age men are those who are most inclined to go out there and try to change the system because it's not working out and their families are suffering. Well, at that point, you know, the authorities, the powers that be, are going to start screaming enemies at the gate, barbarians at the gate. And they're going to start the propaganda about evil barbarians who are coming to destroy our way of life, who will come and sack our towns and kill our children and rape our women and so forth. And then people feel inclined, exactly the right sort of people, they feel inclined to defend their homes and their cities and their country. You have an explosion of patriotic fervor, and let's go kill these evil barbarians, these enemies, whatever, you know, the Huns, the Visigoths, the Russians, the Chinese, whatever. And, you know, that allows the powers that be, the oligarchies in charge, to sacrifice a large number of these people, of the men. Some of them will end up, you know, being loyal and capable, and they'll end up getting privileged jobs in defending the, you know, the established order. And so the system kind of converges on the state of permanent warfare, because you have to keep manufacturing the crises to explain why everything is bad. Oh, because, you know, Muslim extremists and terrorists, and oh no, it's Saddam, it's Assad, it's the Russians, it's the Muslims, it's the Chinese. We have to always be fighting somebody. And every bad thing that happens is explained by pointing to an external enemy and directing people's grievances and anger and hatred towards that external enemy. And so, you know, we've seen that over the last 20 years. You know, we were very strongly encouraged to hate the Muslims. And then, you know, that got old. And then Gaddafi and then Saddam and the Taliban. And, you know, most recently it was the Russians. And now they're building up for the Chinese. And now, you know, courtesy of Israel, we have the Muslim extremists once again, who are now threatening our cities. And so it goes on and on and on. And then you realize, my gosh, you know, we're always at war, but we're also always less and less prosperous than we used to be. And, you know, for the first time in living memory, people today actually expect that their children will be less well off than they were, that we were. And people wonder, well, how come, you know, since, you know, we're so productive, productivity is through the roof, right? It's insane how productive we are. But maybe 50 years ago, one blue-collar job could comfortably maintain a family of four or five. And today, two white-collar jobs can barely make ends meet for, you know, a household of two or three people. And then people start noticing that their kids, you know, they've done everything right. They went to school, they got good grades, they went to university, they got a degree, they got a professional job. But it looks like they're going to be moving back home with the parents because they can't afford the rent and all the other expenses. And so, you know, the whole society is designed in a way that the wealth that we create, the productivity of our labors, the creativity of the people, the inventiveness, merely shifts that wealth gradually but constantly from the people who create the wealth to a very narrow parasitic oligarchy that is draining that wealth away. And because this setup is so valuable to them, they will do everything and anything to keep it intact and to make sure that some revolution doesn't blow up on them and upsets the cart. And the most reliable way of doing that is to constantly invent foreign enemies and to constantly provoke foreign wars and to constantly divert people's attention from the plunder that they're being subjected to in everyday life to the barbarians at the gate. All right, so I hope that made sense. But maybe
and on that with, like, because, you know, we heard like the Rothschilds kind of own the whole banking system or whoever it is that's controlling everything. And I heard there's a few countries that were outside of that. So they were the countries like Iraq attacked, Libya attacked, and Iran is supposed to be another one. Is this part of the whole thing? Because they're kind of saying, oh, Iran is supporting Hamas and all this kind of stuff. Is this just to totally control the whole monetary system?
I believe so, but you know, and then we can even get into that question. You know, how is Iran supporting Hamas? I mean, that would be almost as absurd as saying that Russia is supporting the Azov Battalion in Ukraine. You know, the Nazis in Ukraine. And I'll explain, because this is not clear. And I was on a call recently with people who are, you know, very well informed otherwise, but they're just saying this as though everybody knows it's true. It's just repetition. It's Iran, it's Iran, it's Iran. And I asked them, like, but do you have any evidence whatsoever that Iran has any involvement? Because the Iranians themselves said, we had nothing to do with the Hamas attack on 7th October. And the Israeli government said that they had no evidence that Iran was involved. And the American government said that they had no evidence that the Iranians were involved. But the commentariat keeps repeating it, that it's the Iranians. Allow me to explain. So first of all, we have to distinguish Hamas and Hezbollah. That also people keep mixing up like it's the same thing. It's not. Iranians do support openly the Hezbollah, which is the, Shia Islamic movement and political organization in Lebanon. And they're also a military organization. And they are a real threat to the state of Israel. Okay. Hamas is a different thing altogether. Hamas is the creation of Israel. It was created in order to fracture the political organization of the Palestinian people. You know, very straight up divide and conquer tactic. You know, you had the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was a secular political organization struggling for the emancipation liberation of the Palestinian people. And so Israel helped create Hamas, which was an Islamist Sunni organization, which, well, you know, ostensibly Islamist, but, you know, I'm not even buying that. They are some kind of intelligence front which does have certain political weight in the Gaza Strip, because, you know, they're literally receiving hundreds of millions of dollars, but not from Iran. They're getting it from Qatar, that we know for sure. They're getting it from the United States, and they're probably getting it in some ways from the Israelis and maybe other Arab countries. Well, the fact that they are receiving money from Qatar and from other, let's say, countries that were, at least until very recently, Western allied countries, tells you everything you need to know, because who pays the piper calls the tune. That's just how it is. You know, money is going somewhere, and somebody in the organization has the authorization to dispose of that money, to use it. And they're going to use it in the way the paymaster says. Otherwise, the paymaster is going to withdraw the authorization and is going to give it to somebody else. So, you know, like if you're a, what's his name? Haniyeh, I forget his first name. You're going to do as told. So, you know, the Palestinian people had one, let's call it, reliable friend in the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And they offered a safe haven to Hamas, and they had their headquarters in Damascus. And then when the West decided to crush Syria in 2011, Hamas was offered to move the headquarters to Qatar. They were offered hundreds of millions of dollars in support. They took the money, they stabbed the Syrian government in the back, and they moved to Qatar. And they expressed their support for the, you know, democratic processes in Syria, which, you know, as we know, you know, we had Free Syrian Army, we had the moderate terrorists there, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, you know, all proxies of the Western powers that wanted to break the regime of Bashar al-Assad and regime change Syria. And rather than standing by their friend and ally, Hamas threw them under the bus. So that's who Hamas is. And since Hamas is being paid by the Western intelligence deep state structures, then Hamas is going to do as they told them, as they tell them. And so what happened in Israel, I would not be surprised if there were some inner sanctum of Hamas operatives, the ones that are closest, you know, the ones that probably have signatures on the bank accounts, who made sure that this happened when it was convenient for Israel, who probably mobilized maybe a large group of Palestinian men who sincerely wanted to martyr themselves for, you know, making some kind of a statement for the freedom of Palestinian people. But there was probably a small number of real, true deep state thugs who went and committed atrocities. And now I think that it is pretty clear that this was orchestrated. And, you know, why do I say that? I say that because Israelis opened the gates of Gaza wide to these groups to penetrate into Israel. The American intelligence warned them that something was brewing and that something was going to happen there. The Egyptian intelligence warned them. They just simply didn't act. And not only did they not act, they didn't act for several hours after it was already clear that something was going on. And then also, Hamas is number two. Forgive me, I can't cite his name off the top of my head, but he's based in the West Bank. He's been giving interviews saying that they are preparing armed action against Israel in September, weeks before the attacks actually happened. He was giving interviews to Al Jazeera announcing attacks. So the idea that Israeli government was caught unawares, that they were, you know, just thought everything was cool and they didn't have to even man the Gaza border, is very, very difficult to accept. It has no credibility whatsoever. And then, you know, Israel's reaction, which is what we see now, feels like this is what they intended to do anyway. You know, there's no talk about ceasefire. There's no talk about, you know, turning over those who are guilty to face justice. It's just pummeling the whole area with, what, like 1,000 bombs a day. This could be extremely important this could be extremely dangerous if people somehow convince themselves that this is the work of Iran. And I gave you this whole background because I wanted to make it clear that this is about as likely to be an Iranian operation as, you know, Ukraine's right-wing military formations actions could be attributed to Russia. It just doesn't make any sense. And I think it only, you know, this narrative only got legs because it is so confusing to people. You know, Hamas, Hezbollah, Qatar, Iran, you know, they cannot distinguish. And our media are not trying to clarify any of this. So they're just going with this narrative and people keep repeating it's the Iranians. And, you know, the danger is that this really leads us sleepwalking into World War II. And, you know, it's not only dangerous for all of us, it's extremely dangerous for the Israeli people. You know, they have been placed between the rock and the hard place. And the people who are driving the show have absolutely no regard for their lives any more than have any regard for the life of the Palestinian people.
Like with the technology that the Israelis have, they have the most advanced in the world. I mean, I heard that even if a cockroach was going across the fence, they would know about it. Like, so that's as obvious as it is. But if you even take a few layers back, like during the lockdown, like the countries that were really jabbed to the hilt and were suffering massive consequences because of that was Israel as well. So it's like if they're trying to wipe them out themselves.
Yes, exactly. And I have to confess that I was very surprised by the way the whole pandemic episode unfolded in Israel, because I would have expected that they would go light on the Israeli people, you know, that maybe, you know, the health minister, that his or her whatever policy would be more similar to the way it was in Sweden. But instead, they went really hard. And you know, like I even came across Benjamin Netanyahu bragging about how he was going to turn Israel into, I don't exactly remember every word. I don't want to misquote him, but he was giving this speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos. And the gist of what he was saying is that Israel would be the largest real life experiment or on the population for these mRNA vaccines. And I just could not believe what I was hearing, you know, because this is an experiment, you know, this is an untested technology. This is a product that was developed with extreme haste. It didn't take a genius to think that, wait, you know, even if everything is as they say on the tin, there's risk that we don't know about. So, you know, to go that hard and that ruthlessly and unscrupulously and subject the people to such an experiment told you everything you need to know. They don't care. They don't care at all. They're going to sacrifice them all for their ends.
And what do you see how does the Israelis respond to it? Because I was thinking, Alex, how do you respond to someone when someone talks to you like, okay, my family's in Israel and they're doing okay after the incident, but the government is recalling all fighting age Israelis to sign up. And of course, he said, I'm getting too old for this. So my thought, of course, said, if a lot of Israeli people are really, really awake, then maybe no one should sign up. Because it's not that they're truly defending, but someone said, but if that's your nation and they're being invaded, what are you going to do? I said, well, first I have to ask who's really invading my nation and who's truly running, and I'm signing up for whom? Whom am I fighting for? I said, even if just one family member, that's precious to me. I even said, if that happens in the Philippines, I'm going to say, don't even think about signing up until you know who you're fighting for. So how would you, you know, properly, if there's a proper way of responding that to people whom you might meet, that they are concerned that they're getting invaded? And is this like a way of wiping out a nation? It seems like they really want to do that.
I hope not. But everything you said makes complete and perfect sense. The problem, unfortunately, is that in some nations, the propaganda and the brainwash has been extremely pervasive, and the censorship has been very aggressive. Unfortunately, Israel is one of those nations. And, I don't know many Israelis, but a friend of mine is an Israeli journalist, Efrat Fenningson, and I spoke with her. And, she told me that not many Israelis are awake to all these things, that they are, most people are going with the, you know, mainstream media propaganda, and they're believing things as they're presented to them. And so I think that the situation is very worrisome, particularly now, you know, at this moment when the emotions are running hot, and you know, whatever you say, any small slight inclination to question things, you're immediately attacked as a, you know, like, you're a Hamas supporter, you're a Hamas apologist. And so it's probably a very difficult moment to try to tell people the truth. I hope and pray that external powers will prevail in pressuring the Israeli government to cease and desist before they put not just the Palestinian people into a industrial scale meat grinder, but also the Israeli people with them, because the Israel is surrounded by much, much larger Arab populations. You know, you don't throw rocks if you're living in a glass house. You know, you have to make peace with your neighbors. You cannot live in peace. You cannot live a good life unless you make peace with your neighbors. And it seems to me that the Netanyahu government is going in exactly the opposite direction. You know, barbarians at the gate, everybody to arms, let's go and fight. And I don't quite understand what the point is, what they're hoping to achieve. And it seems to me that it's just Netanyahu, you know, buying another few months or years of his political life with the blood of Israelis and the blood of Palestinians. Maybe I'm wrong, but it, you know, everything I see is suggesting that this is what's going on. And meanwhile, mostly innocent people are paying the price. You know, the Gaza Strip is, you know, their political leadership is Hamas, but 44% of the population are below the age of 14. They're children. What crime have they committed? You know, boys and girls. What have they done to anybody to deserve to be killed?
With, like, if we look at what Israel was doing for the last few years, you know, LGBT plus, NOIQ, that's kind of whatever the plus, all the different things are.
All of it.
Like
all
having it. Tel Aviv, like the gay capital of the world. Like when you consider who was surrounded and their religious beliefs, was that something to kind of annoy them as well?
Well, I don't know if that was to annoy them. You know, I think that was just because they were treating the Israelis to exactly the same globalist agenda as they are treating all the other Western countries, you know, the LGBT thing, the destruction of the family. I also didn't realize that a lot of people in Israel are actually poor, that poverty is rampant, that people are not necessarily well off. You know, there are successful business. I think, you know, the more I learned about Israel, the more it reminded me of Ireland, you know. And because also my Irish friend tell me that not very many people in Ireland are very awake, that, you know, censorship is very aggressive, that propaganda
it's totally
is very...
I mean, I'm Irish. It's compared to what it was. Yes. Like in my day, I'm shocked at how people are just compliant. Yes. Like there's a high percentage that lined up as well for their quadruple booster, and they're attacking the other people. So it's a different nation than it was 40 years ago.
Yeah. And you know, the more I heard about how things were in Israel, the more it sounded to me exactly like in Ireland. And you guys also had LGBT St. Patrick's Day parade, and schools are being completely transformed into these, you know, social justice, LGBT, whatever, indoctrination camps. And people are beside themselves. And, well, that's gonna I think. Sorry, did something break?
Yeah, we just missed you for about 3 seconds there.
Okay, so you know, it seems to me that all of this has been very unpopular, and the things in Israel were not going well at all for Netanyahu, and that he was on the verge of being impeached and thrown out of office, and that he had very, very high probability of winding up in jail. And well, you know, there you go. You go to war. You go to war, and you know you scream barbarians at the gate, and you mobilize the whole society, and you orchestrate a big war. And I don't know if that's coming to Ireland. I hope not, but it, you know,
I think it is, because if you look at like the World Economic Forum and who are all their puppets, like the leader of Ireland is one of them puppets. So is the other guy that was previously, who's supposed to be earmarked for the European Parliament. Like they're all puppets. And
yes, exactly.
And, like the thing is, a lot of people think like Trump is going to be the savior, and he's the guy that there was no wars under him. But I mean, I saw him with Schwab, and he's basically saying what a great man he is and everything. So the way I look at that is he's exactly like Trudeau in Canada. At one stage, there was a fantastic country and half the world was moving there. And then he's told a different narrative and everybody hates him. And I think people think that Trump is going to be the saving grace, whether he gets in or not. Like people think because he's attacked, it's all like, oh, he's the poor victim. But that's all Oxford. I don't know what your thoughts on that, but I'm convinced, like, just from all the things I've seen over the years, that I don't think there's anybody in power that's not controlled.
Well, I think it's very difficult to judge these things, you know, because you cannot, you know, nowadays you cannot come right out and say things openly. You know, if you came out and you said, well, okay, some people can maybe, you know, Viktor Orban, maybe Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus, they can and they do and they have support of their people. But, you know, if you came out and you said, you know, this LGBT stuff is nonsense, there's only two genders, you're dead, you're finished. I mean, people have lost their careers just for saying that there are only two genders, men and women. Literally, you know, and people get character assassinated for less, and they get their careers get destroyed for less. And so if you're running for a political office, you don't need the media to destroy you. And we saw also what happened to Jeremy Corbyn. You know, when they wanted to destroy him, they used his support for the Palestinian causes. They labeled him an anti-Semite. They ran with that and they succeeded. They destroyed him and they turned the Labour Party over to their own puppet boy, Keir Starmer, the great friend of Jimmy Savile, right? And So I think that for people who are in power, it is very difficult for us to judge where they stand. You know, it's not difficult to judge where, you know, Justin Trudeau stands or Joe Biden, but people like Robert F. Kennedy, Donald Trump, you know, Ron DeSantis, I would even say people like German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and Emmanuel Macron, it's very, very difficult to judge where they stand because they cannot do things out in the open. They cannot say things as they see them. They have to kind of move between the goalposts very, very carefully, you know, and then maybe only get a glimpse of what they're doing because they'll be making very clear declarations, but then you'll see that they're really dragging their feet when it comes to execution. You know, Olaf Scholz spent a lot of time speaking with Vladimir Putin. It seemed that he was maybe trying to avoid going to war. And then, you know, when the war happened, the Germans were dragging their feet on providing military support to Ukraine, even though they were declaring themselves to be fully behind Ukraine for, you know, for as long as it takes, all that it takes and so forth. And then they would send them, you know, weaponry that was very difficult to use, very difficult to maintain, or didn't function at all. The same happened from Italian government. So you know, like we are at a juncture when nothing is what it seems. Nothing is what it seems. So I wouldn't be surprised if Robert F. Kennedy and Donald Trump were making statements to make sure that they cannot be subjected to a hysterical media witch hunt, and that they won't jeopardize their chances of winning in the elections. But we'll find out. We'll find out because you know, there things that are happening in the world are extremely strange, and I think it's very difficult to judge where we're at and who's who in the game. And it'll take time before we can like when you mentioned Trump being pictured with Klaus Schwab and they seem like they're friendly. You can also see pictures of Klaus Schwab with Vladimir Putin and they seem friendly, and Vladimir Putin is friendly with
and Trump Klaus with Schwab Epstein, and he's saying that he was only visiting them.
Right. But, you know, when it's time for action, you see that consistently everything Vladimir Putin does indicates that he is not, you know, controlled opposition, that he is not owned, that he is, you know, really in earnest fighting to defend Russia's sovereignty. And I could say the same about Donald Trump, because when you analyze his 4 years in the White House, he was doing some crazy shit, but there was a method to the madness. And then many of the very, very controversial things he had done turned out to be a lot more interesting in hindsight, and very consistently. Everything he did was rolling back the imperial footprint of the United States around the world. You know, he wanted to withdraw troops from Afghanistan. He wanted to withdraw troops from Germany. He wanted to withdraw troops from Syria. He tried to make peace between United States and North Korea. And so on and so forth. Many, many, many different things. I think the one very, very grave mistake he did was the assassination of the Iranian general, whose name slips my mind at the moment. But you probably know the episode I was talking about. So anyway, you know, long story short, we have to kind of observe very carefully and be patient and give people the benefit of the doubt. You know, there was a time when Edward Snowden was also part of the deep state and the military industrial complex. And then, you know, when the time came, he gave them a very, very painful, crippling blow in the court of public opinion. So it's hard to judge who's who.
And I'm not sure, because, you know, we were talking about Ireland, and I've seen letters from the Ukraine. So they're trying to conscription now, bringing the men back. But I've also seen on another show where they're actually trying to get the women as well, which is kind of strange in this day and age that you don't have a choice. I mean, some people want to fight. I would never fight for anybody because, you know, but they're actually being made to leave the country that they, you know, they escaped Ukraine, they escaped the war, and now they're being made go back to fight and, I know, and possibly die.
Yes, yes. I think it's a tragic thing. And I, as somebody who, when I was in my 20s, volunteered to go to war, and I was ready to fight and die for my country, I would tell every single person who is considering doing this, don't. Because you're just gonna get hurt and possibly die for no good reason. The idea of fighting for one's country is maybe appealing at the moment where you think that you have external enemies who are, you know, jeopardizing your life. But, you know, I went into Croatian military. I was there in war. We won our quote unquote freedom from, you know, we won our independence from former Yugoslavia, you know. But then our political leadership gave the country sovereignty on a silver platter to Brussels and to Washington. And so today, we are, you know, people in Croatia are much, much worse off than we were before the war. You know, quality of life has deteriorated. We have no sovereignty left whatsoever. We're using the euro in our country. The central bank and the government have no independence to manage the economic policy as it should be. We just have to follow the dictate from Brussels. That's the liberty we want. And then also, when you think about what does it mean to fight for your country? For what? For roads? For rocks? For what exactly? You know, you have to think about that, because you have one life here. Don't squander it on some stupid political project that doesn't concern you in the least. You know, we in Croatia, we went from being dominated by Belgrade to being dominated by Brussels. And as it turns out, Brussels is a much crueler dominatrix than Belgrade ever was. And that's the liberty that we won. And, you know, thousands of young men sacrificed themselves for that. It's a tragedy. So, you know, if you think you're going to go fight for Ukraine or you're going to fight for Israel or wherever, think twice, and maybe your life is worth more than that.
Croatia, sorry Grace, but like regarding that, because in Ireland, because I'm obviously paying attention to everything that's going on, and I have a lot of friends in the UK, all of the asylum seekers that have come in, they're all military age, and there's even people saying that there was weapons found and everything. Is this going to be martial law that they're going to introduce? Is it going to be a religious war that they're going to push? Because it's not making sense. And now people are standing up and they're starting to block it. But like, they're filling hotels. They're signing contracts for 2 years to fill them up with military men. I can understand, like in Syria, if there's a family, you know, displaced, there's children, women, everybody understands that. But there's people coming here with fantastic clothes, latest mobile phones, and they're all military men.
Yes, I think that the risk and the danger are very much real. It's not an accident that these are all military age men. And I think that there's very high likelihood that there are weapons caches around Ireland. This is the same playbook as the Operation Gladio. The Operation Gladio was conducted during the 1970s and 1980s, early 80s in Italy and Germany, and I think Belgium as well. It was orchestrated by NATO, and so basically it wasn't the immigrants, but it was ostensibly far left, extreme left, communist militias and terror groups who were conducting terror attacks on, you know, on people in Italy and Germany. They blew up a nightclub in Germany. They blew up. They caused several bomb explosions in Italian cities. They blew up the train station in Bologna in 1978, 79, I forget, and they killed something like 80 or 90 people who were, you know, commuters. And as it turned out, and this is not a conspiracy, this was an operation conducted by NATO. And they even kidnapped Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro and assassinated him. And they, you know, they blamed left-wing extremists for it, the Red Brigade, Brigate Rosse, right? But it was NATO behind it. And so, you know, what we see today is probably some variation of that playbook, you know, because I think that, you know, when the social pressures in Ireland, in a place like Ireland, boil over and the ordinary people find common cause with the military and the police, because, you know, Irish police are still Irish and Irish military are still Irish. They might sympathize with the plight of the Irish people. Irish police might sympathize with the plight of the Irish families. So you bring in foreigners who have no roots in the country and who are going to find cushy jobs policing the Irish. And then all of a sudden, they're going to find themselves armed and being the riot control people. You know, when they tell you have to stay in 15-minute cities, you have to stay in your homes, and maybe you ask an Irishman to police that, and maybe they're going to say that's complete nonsense. And I've observed this personally here in France. I wrote an article about it. You know, when they, during the lockdowns, when they opened the beaches in France, and they opened them in a new normal kind of way, you know, where they had, you know, you couldn't just go to the beach. They had a very, very, very strictly defined regime of how you can go to the sea and how long you can stay and where you can go and where you cannot go. And are you allowed to talk to people? It was just horrible. But it lasted 4 days because all the police that were sent to patrol this, first of all, they were local. They knew the people they were supposed to police. Second of all, none of it made any sense. So after 4 days of this, we were back to the new normal. Well, you know, maybe that's a problem because, you know, you have French people policing French people. But if you bring in, I don't know, Algerians to police French people, maybe they will not be so soft on them. Maybe, you know, they will be extremely harsh. And so maybe the people who are in power will feel much safer asking harsh repression against the local population. So I think this is the reason why they are bringing all these military age migrants from abroad, because if the social pressures boil over, they're going to need very, very radical riot control measures, and they will probably not be able to rely on the, you know, ordinary police. They will need military age men from other cultures.
I was just going to say earlier, Roy, that I was in agreement with what how you described, you know, all the massive migration coming in, because that's the same thing as what's happening, of course, in the United States. And, you know, and it's just interesting how a little bit some people who didn't see what was happening during the pandemic, they can see what's happening with the migration. So that was good. But when this thing happened in Israel, suddenly they lost all the being awake again, and they fell into the same trap. So, well, my concern is, Alex, how do you also respond when people say, hey, Grace, this has been happening for centuries. There'll never be a solution. Tell me the solution. And then said, a lot of podcasts I hear, they only pinpoint all the things that are, you know, maybe the roots of it, looking at it, but then no one would say for the solution. And of course, in my own discernment, I see and I hear solutions when people have a conversation, but I fail to use the term on the external factors. External forces are there. So even with that kind of issue that's been going on for eons, it cannot be, seemed like it's never resolvable, because we're not looking at it from the micro to macro, or, you know, we're just not looking at it in so big. So I just wanted you to please explain more or tell more on the possibility of solutions, especially when external factors are, we can see, are the major players. Okay.
Okay, so here's why I think that it's different this time. There's one element to the equation that was never there ever in history before, and that is the internet. So up until the last 20 years or so, we literally had to depend on, you know, printed press and radio and television for information. So for people who controlled those media, it was very easy to control the narrative. And we knew what we knew, and it was very easy for them to deceive us. Today, we see that it's very different. And, you know, going back to where we started, what I started explaining to you, that, you know, I lived through the outbreak of war in former Yugoslavia, and I was very afraid of that happening again between Russia and the West. The thing about the war in Yugoslavia that impressed me the most is that literally maybe 1 or 2 days before the outbreak of war, I can tell you that probably 99% of people never thought that such a thing was possible. And then once it happened, the collective psychology flipped on a dime. And, you know, all of a sudden, the perception was, we really did have enemies at the gate. We really need to all mobilize for defense. There was no more nuanced discussion about this or that, you know, whether Serbs have a point in this and whether Muslims have a point in that. It was defense, enemy was there to be destroyed. And, you know, any military aged man had to, you know, was felt very inclined to go and defend the country, you know, prepared to die for the country. Again, things I no longer recommend at all. This is the scenario I was fearing that might happen between Russia and the West. But it didn't happen that way at all. So there wasn't, you know, when Russia invaded Ukraine, well, you know, when it started their special military operation into Ukraine, this whole polarization of public opinion this whole, you know, population closing ranks behind the leadership and being ready to go to war, and everybody suddenly being very highly motivated to fight the war against the Russians, that just simply didn't happen. And the reason I think it didn't happen is because the traditional media have lost their power. People get most of their information now through social media. The views are much more diverse. The discussions are much more nuanced. And, you know, the French public opinion polling agency, I think it's called IPOF, they conducted a poll in France, I think, within a week of the beginning of Russia's special military operation. And they found that more than half the French people, 57% of all the French people, believed Russian rationale for war. Okay? So there wasn't this like, Russia is bad and evil and we have to go and kill them. People had different opinions. And so, this whole coalescing of the population and readiness to fight a war just simply never happened. And then NATO, I think that the agenda was for all the NATO countries to come together and present a united front against Russia. This didn't happen either. And NATO itself carefully monitors public opinion in the member nations. And they found that majority of people in NATO member nations, with maybe exception of countries like United Kingdom and maybe Poland, most people sympathize with Russia and not with Ukraine. You're never going to hear that in mainstream media, but that is the fact. And I also came across a number of informal polls in social media, but with a very large number of respondents, and it's always between 70 and 80% in favor of Russia. Who started the war? 75%, it was NATO. Whom do you prefer, Vladimir Putin or Vladimir Zelensky? 80% prefer Vladimir Putin. Who do you trust more, United States or Russia? 80% trust Russia and not the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that the internet and social media have very, very meaningfully altered the equation, and all the methods that they have used to orchestrate wars in the past have now failed. And I think that the critical element in all this is the truth. It's what we're doing here. We're trying to, understand the truth and communicate the truth. And the more people we can reach, the more we can blunt the edge of these warmongers to push forward their own agendas. And I think that eventually, longer term, we win in our fight for peace.
Thank you. Roy, you have any more thoughts? But before you share more, Roy, Alex, in your article, you did really mention that do not watch what they do and not what they say. So I like that statement that you wrote in your article as well, because it's true. Okay. And then another thing you wrote as your subtitle is that sending men off to war is like the stone that kills many flies. And that's so vivid for me. I said, how can you hit anyone with a stone and with all the little flies? So anyway.
Well, it's just an expression. It's not the most brilliant expression. Nobody kills flies with stones, but I just use what people understand, right? But
that's perfect.
It is, because not only are you getting rid of military aged men that could constitute a threat to your system if they rebel, But also war, you know, war creates the emergency that then excuses any kind of government abuse. You know, you can, you know, well, we can see that now with Israel and Palestine, you know, when they all of a sudden they are arresting people if they turn up with a Palestinian flag. They are, you know, if they've outlawed demonstrations in France, in Germany, in UK, in that support the Palestinian causes, right? They are what European Commission sent out Thierry Breton around the United States to demand that the social media censor, you know, things about the pandemic and things about Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So, you know, the war creates this emergency that then lets them sweep everything and anything under the carpet. And even the crisis, you know, if there's inflation and you can no longer afford the necessities of life, well, you know, they can say, well, look, the Iranians caused this big war, or Vladimir Putin price hike. That's why you can't afford to live. It's a, you know, war has been incredibly helpful and useful to the Western oligarchies. But I think that the equation has changed and the old playbooks no longer work. And I think that this is a wonderful bit of news. It is news to me. But I think that we, you know, we haven't won the war. We have to keep on insisting on learning the truth, communicating the truth, and making sure that we do not sleepwalk into another massive bloodshed on, you know, on the European continent, but anywhere, in fact.
With, like, just getting the information out, I know podcasts have been a great way of doing it, and it seems like, you know, the popularity of, you know, obviously Rogan, Patrick Bet-David, and a few of them. But I've seen, apparently, that in Canada, they're shutting down one of our previous podcasters that used to be with us. He just got wiped out. They took him down, couldn't get it back on. And the others, like one is in Germany, one's in Singapore, they're basically terrified because of the laws in Germany and the different countries. And I know that they brought in a law in Ireland as well. And people are then afraid to actually even broadcast or do anything. And in another side of it is, I meet a load of people and they all thank me. Thank you for what you're doing. But they're afraid to even give you a thumbs up or any support because they think they'll be targeted. And I think it's a case of we have to stand up and stop fearing them, because that's why they're allowed to do it. Because if you stand up, then your neighbor goes, hey, I believe this as well. And it's going the opposite way. People are just quivering. It's like, I don't care if they bring in a law in Poland. Like, I'm still going to keep doing this.
Well, you know, if we don't, we are condemning our children to live under a tyrannical dictatorship, you know, and we're condemning them to a life that may not be worth living. Because, you know, if the oligarch is ruling the West, and these are, you know, I didn't include this in my explanation in the beginning of where all these problems come from, but they always come from banking oligarchies. That's been true in ancient Greece, that's been true in Rome, in Italy during the Lombard banking period. It's been true of the Spanish Empire that wiped out, you know, the civilization of South America. And it was true also of the Belgian and British empires and the Dutch Empire. Extremely, extremely bloody business every single time. These oligarchies regard us as cattle. We are, you know, we are worth nothing to them. And if they decide that, you know, people are going to live in small pods and eat recycled insect protein in 15-minute cities, that's what's going to happen. So if we allow ourselves to be intimidated into silence, then we are just shifting the battle to our children. I don't think we have the right to do that. And I think that, you know, the one thing that's worth fighting and dying for, you know, it's not the concept of the country. It's your family, right? Men, women would be prepared to lay down their lives to defend their children, their family, their, you know, their immediate social group. And I think that is legit. But this battle is now. This battle is upon us. And to acquiesce, to capitulate to these people, it's an unbearable thought to me, because I think we've also learned who these people are, what they're like. I just cannot bear the thought of them winning, of them prevailing. And I think that we must not be afraid of them. Because, yeah, you know, some of us are going to get hurt. But they can't kill all of us, right? They can't put all of us into prison. And what if you break the law of that, you know, that you know is not a legitimate law, because, you know, you broke the censorship rules. And so what? You're going to find yourself in front of some judge? Well, you know, and then what? That judge might be a human being. They might let you off, or you might
just
be punished.
Just on that, actually, because, like, I mean, I've seen the Yulies and all the people, the Blade Runners and all that, but you're talking about the judges. And, like, even when I saw the letters from the Irish government trying to, you know, take the people to go into the army, if you use UCC and common law, you can actually challenge the jurisdiction. And I think I'm seeing it, because I'm getting a lot of guests coming on doing that, and I'm seeing it's gaining popularity. And people are realizing we weren't born slaves, yet we all are. And once you actually challenge it, you say, hey, prove to me that you actually have control over me, they can't. And the more we kind of realize that, that's where the strength is. And I'm like, that's what's inspiring me. I'm seeing more and more understanding this. And I've fought it myself. I've got courts to back off. I've got, you know, police to back off and everything. I mean, I see the power of this. And it's just like little old me over here. So if you can get like thousands of people doing that, that's how we'll take them down.
Exactly. And I think that we win 100%. The only way we don't win, the only way we lose this battle, is if we capitulate without a fight. And so they are trying extremely, extremely hard to induce us to do exactly that. So they're using scare tactics, intimidation. They're doing everything for us to think, no, resistance is futile. They won, we lost. I'll just be quiet to, you know, not have any inconveniences and any embarrassments or any, you know, problems that they could cause me. But, you know, if you do that, then you're handing them a victory without a fight. And they are horrible people. They don't deserve that, you know? And then you're shifting the battle onto your children. You're saying, yeah, I can't be bothered. It's going to be on you. You're going to be having to live that battle, but, you know, probably in much, much worse conditions. We have a chance. We have a real chance. We have to seize it. And there's a lot more of us than there is of them. There's a lot more of us than there are even prison cells. They cannot fight us. They cannot even fight us. Their only hope is for us to capitulate. Let's not give it to them.
Thank you. Alex, do you want to tell them again where they can engage with you? I have this, but I have also your list of books that you, but anyway, go ahead, please.
So yes, I'm easy to find on Twitter. My handle is @NakedHedgie, and my Substack is right down here, alexcraners.com.
Trend Compass.
Yeah, I don't know if there's an apostrophe in that, but basically Alex Craner Substack or something. It's easy to find. Mm-hmm. And when you say engaged with me, I also have to say that I'm hopelessly overwhelmed by correspondence. And, I was never prepared for that. And I had this impulse to read and reply to every email that comes my way. But now I'm about 2,000 emails behind. And I'm, if anybody listening to this didn't hear from me, I apologize. But I'm having a very hard time getting to all of it. But I will.
And we appreciate all of you listening to us from other places than United States. Thank you from Nova Scotia and from other places. And since I want to make a shout out that since Roy and I are our own sponsors for our podcast, I just want to say that instead of we're looking for sponsors, but we're our own sponsors. So in the post notes, I made sure that I have links like the ones that I'm subscribing to or not subscribing. I'm recommending because, I'm a holistic registered nurse doing also holistic health coaching. So I tend to forget that I have links for where people could go to for their resources for wellness, from their water wellness and other things. So, but it will be in the post notes instead of me doing making that all announcement. And I made my little ticker because we want to, and we want to be self-sufficient in doing this and not depending on any kind of, we accept donations, of course, but you never know. I'm always careful with people. I'm careful. I always pray and hope that we don't attract anyone that might be a controlled opposition or anything or questionable. We don't want to be added into that list, okay? And thank you. Again, please like, subscribe, and support Alex. Listen, you'll get a lot more of fulfillment in that you get more education, right? So even when I classify what kind of podcast, I put education because now I am properly educated. So for you as well, thank you. And have a good evening, everyone.
Thank you very much, Grace and Roy, and all the viewers and listeners. It was a pleasure to be with you today again.
Thank you.
So I hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. You'll find everything about me on bio.link/podcaster with all my podcasts, and you'll find it you see in the QR code in the graphic that's shown. I'd like again to thank my sponsors. So if you or someone you know struggling with anxiety and want to know how to be 100% anxiety-free 6 weeks without therapy or drugs, Daniel Packard's Anxiety Solution Program company offers a 6-week system that permanently solves anxiety at an astounding 90% success rate. People who join the program only pay at the end, once they have clear, measurable results. If you're interested in learning more, go to permanentanxietysolutions.com where you can book a free consultation with Daniel. Do you fight blood pressure and or want to get off the meds? Doctors are amazed at what Zona Plus can do. You can get a $50 discount with my code Roy, zona.com/discount/Roy. And you'll see it in the QR code as well as Daniel's QR code. Quality manufacturer of metal products for telecommunication and workshop equipment and other metal materials. You see the brochure there in the QR code and let me know if you would like a quotation shipped internationally at very competitive price. I'd like to thank all my sponsors and also all my listeners. Be sure to give me a thumbs up, 5-star rating, share with your friends, really helps. And I also have a video on how to give a 5-star rating because a lot of people have wrote to me asking me that they don't know how to do that. Until next week, take care.